Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Doug Begger takes on one of the most volatile international rivalries in the world, the conflict in South Asia between Pakistan and India. No issue embodies this rivalry more clearly than the region of Jammu and Kashmir. Resolving this issue would ease tensions between these two nuclear powers. What's driving the conflict in Kashmir? Would granting the region independence lead to peace? How can we resolve it?
On February 14, 2019, a pro-Pakistani group called Jaish-e-Mohammed attacked an Indian convoy in Jammu and Kashmir, killing 40 members of the Indian Central Reserve Police Force. On February 26th, 12 Indian jets struck across the so-called line of control. Pakistan retaliated with an airstrike to minimal damage. Considering the tensions in this area and the nuclear status of the two states, the risks over such confrontations are quite considerable. Our guests are T.V. Paul, the James McGill Professor of International Relations at McGill University, and the author of several articles and books, including the recently published Restraining Great Powers, Soft Balancing from Empires to the Global Era, and Mona Bhan, Ford Maxwell Chair of South Asian Studies in the Department of Anthropology at Syracuse University. She's the author of several books and articles and has recently co-edited a book on Kashmir, Resisting Occupation in Kashmir, with scholars from the Critical Kashmir Studies Collective, of which she is a founding member. So let's start with TV. Could you please give us a brief background as to what transpired and what led to the February events?
Yes, the February events were quite a random event. But what you notice is that in this rivalry, you find these periodic eruptions often initiated by individuals or groups that allegedly have connections to the Pakistani establishment. But in this case, an individual from Kashmir, or Jammu actually itself, slammed a car into a convoy of Indian troops going into Kashmir and killed some 40 of them. It's perhaps the largest attack on a group of Indian soldiers other than in wartime. So the Indians naturally took it as a major event, and it generated a lot of antagonism toward Pakistan, because the assumption is that the Jaish-e-Mohammed is headquartered in Pakistan and that the Pakistani establishment is supporting this activity. And so since then, you had a kind of intense tension-related period, although yesterday the Pakistani government rearrested the Jaish-e-Mohammed chief, Masood Azhar, and also opened the Pakistani airspace for all the flights coming in through South Asia to India and to other parts of Asia. And this is somewhat of a cooling down, but I'm not sure we are seeing any permanent peace of any sorts anytime soon, as any individual act like that can trigger another round of conflict rather rapidly.
And Mona Bhan, what is at the core of this conflict? Is it about territory or about identity or about history? What's driving this conflict?
I actually don't see this act that happened, the Pulwama attack, as so the attack on the convoy as a random attack. I see it as part of this very long history of Indian presence in Kashmir, which it, of course, tracks back to the history of accession, to the instrument of accession between India and the Dogra Maharaja in 1947. So for me, the history of this event needs to really be tracked back to 1947, or perhaps even earlier, maybe to the 1930s, when Kashmiris, for the first time, really kind of came together, mobilized to seek independence, to seek freedom from the monarch who they saw as an outsider. They saw him as a representation of foreign rule in Kashmir. So to me, this is not a random attack. This is really just part of this long history of India's occupation of Kashmir, illegal occupation of Kashmir, which it, of course, tracks back to, as I said, to the instrument of accession. That's for most Kashmiris is a provisional instrument of accession, does not necessarily cement India's legal control over Kashmir in any way. So that's the history, briefly, and I can speak more to how I see the attack. And it was a young man from Kashmir who basically attacked the convoy. So while we might track it to Pakistani machinations, which is what the Indian line has been. Indian line in Kashmir has always been consistently promoting an indigenous struggle for freedom from India as a proxy war of Pakistan. Now, this is not to deny, I'm not denying that Pakistan has a role to play in this, but we have to first and foremost foreground Kashmiri agency in this long-drawn struggle against the Indian state.
And T.V. Pong, I mean, part of what we're describing is what's referred to by historians as the partition. In what ways has the partition and its aftermath contributed to such destabilization of this region?
The partition was one of the most tragic events happened to this subcontinent, as everyone knows. The British left in such a hurry that the state was not there to protect millions who perished or had to migrate from their homelands to a different between India and Pakistan. And so the partition is still looming large. It is an unfinished business. Kashmir is actually the unfinished business of the partition. And partition gave the right to each of the princely state to accede either to India or Pakistan. Obviously, that's a very cumbersome story to describe here. And Mona is right that the Kashmiri people, I mean, have been demanding sort of independence or something related, but she's wrong in saying that Pakistan's role is limited. Without Pakistan, there is very little movement would have persisted this long because it is an irredentist struggle for Pakistan. Pakistan wants to assimilate both parts of Kashmir as part of its national identity and narrative, and without it, its elite feels that Pakistan will never be complete. India, on the other hand, views it as a testament for its identity of a so-called secular state, and that giving away this again under threat to Pakistan will considerably weaken the Indian unity as well as the secular credentials. So now one can question whether these arguments have much substance. And where Mona is partially right is the role of Kashmiri people there. But the question is, who are the Kashmiri people? Are they the movements, that is, the separatist movement representing all of Kashmir? There is a sizable Hindu, sizable Buddhist minorities in Kashmir and Jammu Ladakh area. And so the largest movement is actually happening in the Vale of Kashmir, which is Muslim dominated, certain kind of a certain part of Kashmir at this point. So it's hard to say everyone in Kashmir wants to separate. There is a sizable number that would still want to be part of India but definitely don't want to join Pakistan. And that is where the whole problem arises. Imagine if Kashmir ever becomes a kind of independent state, will it be abandoned by Pakistan? Very unlikely. Pakistan is run by a military system, and this regime, and you know, this sort of it's very unlikely they will forgo Kashmir as they are doing with Afghanistan. They haven't given Afghanistan any possibility for emerging as a normal state. So it's okay to say that Pakistan is not is only marginally important here. I disagree with that part. I agree with the fact that the Indian state has failed in a big way to either integrate or give some kind of sense of belonging, and it's now out of their hand. But what is happening today is it has become such an important dimension of India's political discourse and Pakistan's too, that it is unlikely that Kashmir gets independence anytime soon. The reason why I'm saying is that the Hindu fundamentalists or BJP that has come into power really find this as a great issue on which to maintain their rule, and they are winning elections in the name of acting tough on Kashmir, acting tough on Pakistan.
Right.
They're losing, let me just conclude, very few sympathizers within India for Kashmir. And so Kashmir will boil like this, and India will continue unlikely to give up anytime soon.
Mona Bhan, what is your response?
Yes, absolutely. In no way did I want to undermine Pakistan's role. In fact, Pakistan is a legitimate stakeholder in this issue, and I think that's been part of the problem in how the issue has been narrativized by India, most predominantly that it seeks to delegitimize Pakistan's stakes in Kashmir, which is not legally or politically or historically correct. So I'm not denying Pakistan's role, and nor am I saying that Pakistan is not a legitimate stakeholder. What I'm really expressing, what I'm questioning here is this constant reduction of Kashmir to a border dispute between India and Pakistan. Because what tends to happen is, in that narration, when Kashmir is reduced to this border dispute, Kashmiri aspirations, political aspirations, historic aspirations for independence or for alternative territoriality is completely subsumed within this larger border dispute. So a lot of Kashmiri scholars, for example, a lot of Kashmiris, civil society members, a lot of human rights workers, for example, will constantly reiterate this position that, you know, don't reduce us to a border dispute between India and Pakistan. We have our own legitimate aspirations that get completely erased when Kashmir is promoted or projected as a border dispute, as a bilateral issue. Well, in many ways, India doesn't even want to acknowledge that it's a bilateral issue, because India keeps pushing for this narrative that Kashmir is in essentially its internal matter, which it is not, given that it's a pending matter with the UN. It's been a pending matter with the UN for the last 70 years now. It's an international dispute. But for Kashmiris right now, the problem is not necessarily about India and Pakistan alone. The problem is Kashmiris themselves trying to fight for their legitimate rights. So I would correct TV Paul's assessment of my statement. I was not denying Pakistan's involvement at all. On the contrary, as I said, we do need to recognize it's a legitimate stakeholder. And there has been a proxy war, absolutely. But to call it just that is not paying due attention to what's really been happening on the ground in Kashmir. Now, having said that, I do agree that, you know, Pakistan has its own vested interest in claiming Kashmir as its part, and so does India. Going back to this moment of partition in 1947, India, of course, wanted to hold on to this territory because Kashmir legitimized India's secular identity. Now, we are at a very interesting moment. And this will also help me respond to TV Paul's earlier question about diversity within Kashmir. We are at a very interesting point. We are seeing, there's an establishment, an indisputable establishment of a Hindu state in India under Narendra Modi, especially as he came back with such a thumping majority for his second term. Now, what's fascinating to me is it's a very interesting moment where India is no longer interested in maintaining its secular credentials. That's not what its project is. Its project in Kashmir is very different. Its project in Kashmir is to Hinduize that territory. And it's been doing that through a number of, and this is not just the BJP, of course, doing it, but under the BJP, it's taken on a very sort of brutal dimension where you're trying to Hinduize the territory through pilgrimage tourism, through different kinds of, recasting of space, territory, and people as civilizationally Hindu. There's also this assault on Article constitutional privileges that Kashmiris enjoyed so far under Article 370, Article 35A, which basically provides special rights to Kashmiris, recognizing its constitutional provisionality, that relationship of provisionality with India, recognizing that. So what the BJP is trying to do now is dismantle those privileges in order to fully assimilate Kashmiri territory and its people into the Indian mainstream. Having said that, I also want to dispute this notion that, this project of freedom or this project of self-determination that Kashmiris are fighting for is necessarily only limited to Kashmir. Why I say this is, and I've written about this extensively in the past, the problem is there's been a divide and rule policy followed by the Indian government and its puppet regimes in Kashmir for the longest time, for the past 70 years now, because of which you have three different provinces of Ladakh, Jammu, and Kashmir now seemingly completely split politically. But that does not mean there are no issues, for example, in Ladakh, right? In Ladakh, there's a border, and there's a line of control. I should not call it a border. It's a line of control. It's a provisional line, a de facto border between India and Pakistan that splits families, that has split families for the past 70 years. People want to meet each other. And we cannot essentially make any strides insofar as, toying of relationships, cross-LOC relationships is concerned, unless the Kashmir issue is resolved. So while Ladakh and Jammu might seem very different, their aspirations might seem very different, but ultimately it is all connected to this impasse, this political impasse on Kashmir between India and Pakistan. So India and Pakistan's rivalry that we've been talking about mean nothing without Kashmir. So unless Kashmir is resolved, the rivalry will continue to unfold. It will continue to take on different forms across time. There might be some thaw, there might be some sort of, easing of relationship, but nothing will really come out unless we resolve Kashmir and tackle it as a political problem, keeping in mind Kashmiri aspirations, for sure.
Let me respond a little bit, because there is a chicken or egg problem here that was raised, very important. By the way, I am quite sympathetic to the Kashmiri struggle in terms of the kind of human rights violations as well as for autonomy. I have serious doubts that Kashmir will ever become independent. And thousands of young people are mobilizing for this idea of somehow, because independence, some 500 groups would like to be independent in the modern world. Many of them are suppressed by majority groups. And within India, you have the Northeast, quite a few. What is the big distinction here is neither India nor Pakistan would allow an independent state. It may be independent in what you call a very legalistic sense, but it is potentially an Afghanistan, given the ethnic composition and the tendency of involvement by these two are vying for status and domination and creation of their own version of nation state in the subcontinent. And so, however we characterize it, unfortunately, whenever there is violence of this magnitude, it just generates such nationalism in India, and which, unfortunately, if you like it or not, has the upper hand in terms of military force. And one can say that a lot of powerful states had to give up their control over territories, but many haven't. So it's not clear how easy it's going to achieve this goal of independence, but something other than independence. I went to actually give a talk at the university in Kashmir once, Srinagar, and I suggested, look at the Quebec model, the model where it's semi-autonomous. Basically, the hydropower that Quebec sells, and it runs its own foreign ministry. It's very autonomous within Canada. Some models like that, rather than this idea of whatever historical reasons are there, many historical injustices have occurred in the human history, in South Asia in particular. So it's going to be extremely difficult to achieve this goal. And we need to think of mechanisms, at least in the short run, that alleviate the pain that the Kashmiri people suffer, as well as satisfy some level of interest of the three parties, at least when you look at this in that way. One should acknowledge that Kashmir is unfortunately in the wrong strategic space. Whether we like it or not, it is actually in the corner of the world where the interest of these powers, increasingly China, by the way, intersect. And the great powers, big powers, rarely give up unless they are forced to. And India's aspiration today is, I'm not justifying anything that Narendra Modi does or anything. I'm saying that it is to achieve the goal of a great power. And they know that if they let Kashmir go, that may suffer in their mind. So to assume that somehow this movement is going to be achieved in anybody's lifetime in the next few decades, very, very unlikely unless India disintegrates, which I don't see going to happen. So we have to think of alternative models and structures if we want to increase the economic and political rights of the Kashmiri people.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're speaking about the ongoing conflict in Kashmir between India and Pakistan with T.V. Paul of McGill University and Mona Bon of Syracuse University. Part of what both of you have raised has been a bit of a shift in Indian politics, and partially to do with the centralization of the state and the centralization of Hindu identity versus secularism, so that the Congress Party had made certain sort of political promises upon independence about secularism and about regional autonomy. And with the rise of the BJP and the marginalization of Congress, or at least Congress's inability to win elections in India, part of the BJP's appeal in India is to step back from some of those promises and to instead promote a more centralized state and to promote a more sort of centralized Hindu and Hindi identity. But Mona Bon, is there an option that hasn't been explored? T.V. Paul raises this question about a possibility of some sort of recognition of the unique character of Jammu and Kashmir in a less centralized, more autonomous state, or is independence or irredentism with Pakistan really the only options that the Pakistanis, or at least Jammu and Kashmiris of Pakistani descent, would accept?
So there have been a number of political parties, mainstream political parties, that essentially, because just taking a step back, so far India has used democracy, right, as a way, or elections as a way to prop up its military regime in Kashmir, right? That's been happening now for the last 70 years. Elections in Kashmir were never really free or fair, and never truly represented the will of the people. Now, that's been happening repeatedly from the 1940s onwards, something we do need to keep in mind, because India will repeatedly use democracy as a way to legitimize its rule, and also it's India's favorite to go identity globally, because it recognizes itself or self-identifies as a democracy and is recognized internationally also as a democracy. So I just want to make sure we recognize that its operations in Kashmir have never been democratic, whether under the Congress or now under the BJP. Having said that, there were mainstream parties supported by, of course, the Indian government from the 1970s onwards that tried to push for autonomy, this model of autonomy within the Indian, within the Indian state. We've come to a point in Kashmir where nothing short of the end of, and I'm articulating what people tell me, so this is the language that you will hear on the street, there's nothing short of the end to Indian occupation that's acceptable to Kashmiris as of now, given what's been happening for the last 70 years. There's a new generation of dissenters, of resistors, of rebels, right, that's come of age in the last 20, 30 years. And there are seasoned people, seasoned youngsters who completely, fully recognize the Indian machinations of autonomy in that region. And there's no trust left. There was no trust to begin with, but in the past few years now, it's very clear to them that nothing short of the project of self-determination will allow Kashmiris to articulate their true political sentiments. Having said that, I also want to, I want to point out that, I get it. It's hard for us to see empires crumble because they seem so grand, but empires have crumbled in the past. There was British colonialism in India, which did come to an end. It might have been very hard for us to see it coming to an end, but it did. Pontificate on the continuity of the empire in Kashmir is also, I think, to predict, to try to predict history. We don't know how things will happen. We don't know what climate change, for example, is going to bring to the table. We don't know how climate is going to become a very important political actor, has already become an important political actor, but will become increasingly so in the coming years, and how that might shift the balance of power. You know, for the balance of power to shift, something seismic needs to happen. But also something incremental could potentially shift that and perhaps change, you know, the global order that we see right now. So I don't know if that was really a response to your question about anything. I heard you ask if anything short of, you know, Azadi or freedom would be satisfactory to Kashmiris. I don't think so, especially because, as I said, the last 4 or 5 years under Modi's regime now, and also a caveat, for Kashmiris, things have changed now under Modi's regime, but they don't really see much of a difference, right, when it comes to the Congress and their policy on Kashmir. Both the BJP and the Congress have maintained this very stronghold. They have maintained their stronghold over Kashmir by calling it an integral part of India. So insofar as their policy approach to Kashmir is concerned, it's not that different. What's, of course, different is the velvet gloves are off now, right? So up until 2014, there was, hearts and minds operations that were at work. So there was a lot of that velvet feel to that occupation. But now that's off. So you see more draconian policies in place. You do see, as I said, the end of this quote-unquote secular regime in India. It's out and out a Hindu state, and people recognize that. Muslims in India have started feeling terribly uncomfortable. So it's not just about Kashmiris crying out hoarse about their suppression in under Indian rule, but also Muslims in India who are terribly uncomfortable, very, very scared of their future in India. So the way things have unfolded in the past 4 or 5 years now, with the kind of brutality and the kind of victimization, the kind of suppression, the forms of oppression that you see right now, the anger level in Kashmir is very, very, very high, right? So we have to take that into account. So no sort of hearts and minds approach, no engagement, no soft power, policies of the Indian government are going to work. They never worked in the past, and increasingly now, given the scale of anger, the widespread resentment against India, it's become even more impossible for any of this to work.
I may intersect you. You, a couple of things you say, for instance, what is the reaction of the Indian state? The Indian state is hardening its position. Why is that so? I mean, we have to think, and you rightly mentioned the minority situation in India is getting quite difficult, and it's potentially, it has the potential to become a losing some of the secular credentials it had, well, partly because the Congress party is nowhere in the scene anymore. And the BJP, especially the Prime Minister and his few of his associates, run the show. And you need some sympathizers for any kind of transformational policies. And under the past few years in particular, what you notice, earlier there were some people in India, at least, who were talking about giving Kashmir more autonomy, etc. And that number is decreasing day by day. And that's partly because of the strategy that, by the way, not all Kashmiris have adopted. A small section is into the kind of attack we notice. And that attack, when 40 Indian soldiers are killed, the Indian public gets very animated. And we can say that that's not a big deal because you're doing that to them anyway. But that is where the big difference today, the Indian state is, its coercive capacity is increasing. It's buying all the weapons it can. And domestically, it's becoming intolerant to some extent. And so why would the Kashmiris expect anything greater going to happen to them? Unless, I don't know how to, what to put it. The whole world is going through this populist phase.
Oh, absolutely.
There's hardly any democracy that you find inclusive, look at what is happening in the United States today. I mean, it's just the impression that you are giving is somehow because the Kashmiris are boiling, they will achieve their goal. I think it is basically a narrative that has led many youngsters into these sort of actions, activities. Unfortunately, again, I am not unsympathetic to their cause, but I am very unsympathetic to the means they are adopting, and especially with the help of Pakistani intelligence agencies.
Right, but,
and so we have to be careful when you say all of Kashmir is in this struggle, in this modus operandi as we are witnessing.
No, I think we do need to recognize here two completely contradictory things, right? So on the one hand, we are blaming, we're constantly talking about the Pulwama attack. We're talking about 40 CRPF soldiers who ended up dying that day. And I'm extremely sympathetic to that. But you also have to recognize that Kashmir is dying every day for the past 30 years. So while there's rage in India against this, there's deep rage in Kashmir against the massive, you know, the presence of a massive military state like this. It's the most densely militarized state in the world today. I mean, I just was reading an article today with crores and crores of acres of land that's under military occupation. So while I see your point that, you know, there's this rage against these violent attacks by Kashmiris on Indian security forces, I don't see why that rage is legitimate, but the rage that Kashmiris feel against the Indian state is not. And for some reason, we expect them to, we just expect them to contain that rage and figure out a way to live peacefully, with this occupying state. I think that's to an extent seems a little hypocritical to me, given that, Kashmiri rage is as real, if not more, given how much suffering has happened. Now, to your point that because there's no future, therefore people should not demand what is their fundamental right. Now, that's a bigger question. So just because India is draconian right now, just because India is expanding its military power right now, Kashmiri should just sort of sit quietly and not really champion for their rights, is also, I think, a little problematic. So instead of saying, well, let's figure out a way for the international community to mobilize around Kashmir, to mobilize around these other places that are demanding their rights, that includes many other places. Of course, it's not just Kashmir. We are actually forcing people, marginalized people, to just succumb to these military powers just because we don't envision a future for them. So I just don't understand why our rage should be not directed against these coercive forces, against these fascist forces that are mobilizing, and instead of, and why we should be directing it to people who are fighting for their rights. And these are legitimate rights. Now, having said that, I also want to, I know that, Paul, you keep coming back to how this is not all Kashmir. This is just a slight segment of Kashmir fighting for this right.
I'm talking about the violent struggle that only a segment is engaging in. And
right.
It is not at all clear that the entire Kashmiri is supporting.
Yeah. So to respond to that, I think something to keep in mind here, and if you have your pulse on the ground, you will know how, for example, Mananwani, who was, what Kashmiris would call a mujahid, a militant, a rebel, when he penned a letter before he was killed by the security forces, in which he talks about violence, right? He talks about violence and nonviolence. He talks about the continuities between violence and nonviolence in a struggle of this kind, in a long-standing struggle against a mighty, state. And he talks about this sort of, it's an elusive difference between violence and nonviolence, because many people who fight nonviolently in the struggle do not necessarily pit themselves against folks who adopt violent methods, because you recognize that violence becomes sometimes a last recourse for a lot of people in the struggle. As you yourself mentioned, these are coercive forces. There's nothing that speaks to them, perhaps, other than these unfortunate, quote-unquote, violent acts. So I do want to question this binary between violence and nonviolence sometimes that we very easily use to legitimize certain struggles and delegitimize others. But on the ground, the difference between violence and nonviolence is actually quite blurry. Now, for example, a stone pelter in Kashmir, is that violent or is that nonviolent? I mean, how can we categorize what happens when thousands of acts of people come out in the streets to protest, to stone pelt, or lakhs of people come out to mourn the death of a rebel, right? What do we call that? Do we not see that as, or for that matter, the other day when India lost, the World Cup, there were thousands of people came out on the streets and lit firecrackers. When the state responds to that action violently, why is that not the locus of our attention? It's something I would really, push us to consider. Because I think it becomes a very easy escapist language to call it violent and therefore delegitimize it. And to say that only few folks in Kashmir believe in the violent struggle. When in fact the boundaries, as I said, between violence and nonviolence are very blurry from the get-go.
When we come back, how can India alter its governance in the region to promote peace building? How much is the conflict driven by local actions in the region? How much is fueled by policies in Islamabad and New Delhi? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Today, Doug Begger takes on one of the most volatile international rivalries in the world, the conflict in South Asia between Pakistan and India. No issue embodies this rivalry more clearly than the region of Jammu and Kashmir. What's driving the conflict in Kashmir, and how can we resolve it?
I'm Doug Begger. Our guests are T.V. Paul, the James McGill Professor of International Relations at McGill University, and the author of the recently published Restraining Great Powers, Soft Balancing from Empires to the Global Era, and Mona Bhan, Ford Maxwell Chair of South Asian Studies in the Department of Anthropology at Syracuse University. She has recently co-edited a book on Kashmir, Resisting Occupation in Kashmir, with scholars from the Critical Kashmir Studies Collective, of which she is a founding member. So far, we've talked about local actors, we've spoken of Indian and of Pakistani interests, but this is a conflict area that has drawn quite a bit of interest external to the region. I know, Mona Bhan, you've mentioned the United Nations. T.V. Paul, you mentioned the role that China is playing. I also know the United States, has had an interest in this area that has been heightened really certainly ever since the U.S.-led operations in Afghanistan and just a larger presence in the region. And Russia's had interest in this region for quite some time. So I'll start with you, T.V. Paul. The role of external actors that might either contribute to a greater amount of violence or a greater risk of violence, and in particular, considering the military capacities of the two states as both being now nuclear-armed states, are external actors playing more of a peace-building role, more of a conflict-driven role, or more of a role more like observation?
Unfortunately, external actors are losing interest in this thing. Unless there is attack or major crisis, as happened in February, where the U.S. did help to settle the Indians and the Pakistanis to sit down. But the problem is, despite Mona's articulation here, you need international sympathy and support, strong support, for a secessionist or any independence movement to win. what is happening is this movement in Kashmir that she is talking about is losing that support, because partly because India is becoming stronger as well as able to create diplomatic ties with different countries, including some of the Gulf countries. So the lack of support for the Kashmiri movement is partly a problem. Only country that is actually trying to engage up to a point and through its own policy at this point, economic policy at this point, is China. But China, India does not look at China as a favorable supporter of its position. And unfortunately, the Chinese economic, China-Pakistan economic corridor, which India claims is going through some portions of Pakistani side of Kashmir, that India considers now that as this as another challenge to its rule. And therefore, the problem is China always talks about solving the problem, but China is not an active player in diplomacy or actually any sort of settlement of the region, regional issues. So the problem that despite Mona's articulation here and desire for a solution, the sympathizers are declining in number. And within India, that's why I want to emphasize that, who in India would support the Kashmiri movement as presented here because of the continuous violence, at least from their perception, is not doing the response that you're expecting. Now, one can say that. That does not mean that the state's reactions are always correct or repressive. I think they are repressive. And the Indian state, by the way, despite being so democratic and all that, has suppressed a couple of major secessionism in Punjab, the Khalistan movement, through very rough military use of force. And in South Asia, we have this problem. The states in South Asia tend to use coercive power to suppress nationalist movements. So Sri Lanka, there was a brutal war that killed the Tamil Nadu movement. In Balochistan, the Pakistani military is using extraordinary coercion and force. And in India itself has been using force in Northeast India in particular. And it has claimed that it stopped, at least to some extent, the Khalistan movement through violent means and suppression. And so it's impossible to, when a military planner in India says that, okay, we can take on this as long as it can go, as long as India has the ability to fight back, it will. And now the problem is India-China rivalry, systemic rivalry, is becoming enlarging to the larger Asia-Pacific, Indo-Pacific, as they call it. And Kashmir problem, unfortunately, won't be the number one in their minds. Any of these external players, Russia, you mentioned, Russia has no interest in India disintegrating or suffering any way. United States has become closer to India. And in fact, that's a factor that you have to take into account. U.S. is obviously interested in a settlement, but there is no pressure from the U.S., by the way, for any kind of settlement at this point in time, because the U.S. has other geopolitical interests to keep India as a strategic partner. So we have to think the larger context is not in favor of the Kashmiri movement. I'm sorry to say, Hannah, this is situation. We can dream about it. I think you are right on arguing that the state's reactions have been extremely ruthless. But there are larger forces working here. We should not just ignore them if you want to understand the dynamics of this conflict.
Absolutely. And I hear your point, and I couldn't agree more that there are these, at times, vicious alliances, the burgeoning military alliances, for example, between India and Israel being the case in point, India and America being the case in point. I see that, but there's also, I would say, the pockets of hope. I'm also equally pessimistic about the unfolding international geopolitical order that we're witnessing. But at the same time, there are these pockets of hope. Last year, the UNHCR released its first ever extensive report on Kashmir. I'm not sure if you read it, but I would recommend sharing it maybe with your readers too, because I think it's quite a compelling report Because one, I think it outlines one basic dimension about the Kashmir issue, which of course sets it very much apart from what's been happening, for example, in Punjab or for that matter in the Northeast. And the thing that sets it apart is it's a matter which is still with the UN. That is its history. That is its unique history. And the UNHCR report basically has pushed India and Pakistan both to grant access to its special rapporteurs, to grant access to its team of investigators to look into human rights violations and so on and so forth, which, of course, India didn't grant. And then Pakistan stepped in and said, we can grant access only if India would grant access, which is terribly unfortunate. The point being that the UNHCR report came out, the first ever report came out in 2018. The second report came out just maybe a fortnight ago. It was a second extensive report basically asking for a commission of inquiry to be set up in Kashmir. But the other thing that I want to also outline is in the first report, it's very, very important to keep in mind that self-determination is listed as a human right. Oftentimes what we see happen in Indian academic and policy circles is there's a lot of support, for example, to counter the human rights violations of the Indian government, the Indian military in Kashmir, but then people stop short of asking for a political resolution. So oftentimes human rights then becomes a way to depoliticize the larger context. But in the report itself, you see that self-determination is listed as a human right, and the UNHCR report pushes India and Pakistan to recognize that right as a fundamental one for Kashmiris. And there's other European Parliament, there's one such open space where there is some kind of solidarity work happening around Kashmir. So yes, I mean, I do not deny the fact that we need to be realist about what we're up against. And there are these regimes that are, of course, coming together in interesting ways, either through trade or through, you know, other kinds of strategic interventions. But there's also other kinds of things happening where the civil society has played an instrumental role in trying to push forth for a solution for Kashmir that is in accordance with people's long-term aspirations and rights. So I won't discount all that energy, all that fervor, just because we are at a very unfortunate political moment. Again, as I said, I'm optimistic about the fact that things can change because that's how our history has unfolded. So yes, while we might be in a very unfortunate moment as of now, that configuration of power will shift, and it might shift for worse. Absolutely, I hear your point, but we cannot fully predict what the future will bring, especially as I would argue in my work, I have argued this extensively, that, you know, climate change will become a very important source of politics and an important force of politics. And it, again, might shift things for the worse or for the better. We don't know that yet. So I won't give up hope on what, you know, these small-scale initiatives can hopefully lead to.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're speaking about the ongoing conflict in Kashmir between India and Pakistan with T.V. Paul of McGill University and Mona Bon of Syracuse University. Now, what made the February events so difficult or so threatening to people from the outside was this was the first time that I can recall since the 1998 nuclear tests that India had responded to one of these asymmetric or these terrorist-like attacks with the use of conventional weapons, and Pakistan responding with the use of conventional weapons. And of course, immediately there were concerns about the possibility of escalation. And so it seems like the response to the attack made this unique for the potential of escalation. Sort of as the last main question, are these fears legitimate or are they being stoked? Because whenever anybody's asked what's the possibility of a nuclear exchange, of some sort of nuclear strike, immediately people say, well, India and Pakistan over Kashmir. TV, Paul?
So, yes, I agree that this was the first time after, by the way, Kargil in 1999, mm-hmm. where very close to kind of at least a threat of nuclear use. And it was President Clinton who intervened and invited Nawaz Sharif, the prime minister at that time, and asked them to leave, vacate the post within the Indian side of Kashmir. And so this is what is different here is the Indian response. The Indian forces, at least several of the aircraft penetrated Pakistani, Mirage aircraft penetrated Pakistani territory and attacked an area, Balancourt, where supposedly non-state actors were residing. And there is considerable dispute whether they hit the targets or they hit some trees and returned. And then there was a Pakistani intervention, Indian side, and there was a shooting down of a MiG-21 aircraft, and an Indian pilot was captured. He was returned. During this time, the nuclear fear was coming back into the play because, as far as we know, Pakistani doctrine, military doctrine, says it will raise the nuclear threshold if India ever intervenes within its or attacks within its territory proper. And so the daring manner in which India or Narendra Modi's government did that gave him a big attractive platform for the election that was happening a few months later in May. And what is likely to happen if anything like this again happens, India is likely to retaliate, thinking that the Pakistanis are not going to do much because, or other third parties would intervene, as it happened again in this case with the United States. So the thresholds are tested by both sides. And what is surprising is that before that, India also had this conflict with Pakistan, but rarely it was used for electoral purposes. So now Modi has figured out that this is a big electorally a big winner for him, even though the economy is not doing all that well and a lot of people have suffered under some of his reforms. So this is unlikely to go away. And the nuclear factor is again worrisome because Pakistan has at least claimed to deploy some tactical weapons on the border with India, arguing that if India reacts massively to any kind of conventional or insurgency, Pakistan will then respond that with nuclear attack. So at least rhetorically, they are raising the thresholds. But the other change is happening within India's doctrine itself. India used to have what you call a no first use doctrine, but there are considerable pressures within India to abandon that or to tone down, which means if India expects Pakistan to respond nuclear or raise the nuclear level, India could preempt or prevent, engage in a preventive attack. And all these are unlikely, but at the same time, not beyond the realm of possibility. So escalation control is difficult here because the parties don't talk much. They don't have much interaction. And they occasionally meet. I mean, last week they had meetings and somehow sorted out some of the issues. So there's nothing happening in that relationship that gives you a pause for hope, despite all the expectation that somehow things will calm down. Nuclear deterrence has not prevented this sub-strategic level conflict going on in the region. And it's going to get worse because of the electoral aspect in India's case.
I agree with that. I think Kashmir remains a nuclear flashpoint and a very grave one at that. And if nothing, then that is something that should definitely alarm the international community. Going back to what TV Paul said, when Modi used the attack, the Balakot attack, as a way to win the elections, it was a very, commentators have called it a reckless move. It was essentially a move to showcase India's muscular nationalism. That's essentially what that move was. So very thoughtless, but of course strategic to the extent that it won him an election. That's why I feel that we do need to take very seriously the status of Kashmir as a nuclear flashpoint, because that's a real one. And given that we have reckless governments in place, governments that are very, very invested in consolidating their power base, regardless of what the larger implications for communities and nations and the world might be, we do need to take into account Kashmir's status right now as a nuclear flashpoint, and therefore urge, you know, international community to act quickly and speedily to resolve this long-standing issue.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both of our guests, TV Paul and Mona Bond, for a spirited and very informational, very educational conversation about this extremely important issue, and the hope that at least through these conversations and an opportunity to, you know, to learn the issues, and hopefully the opportunity for activism to try to, at a minimum, diffuse this flashpoint and to promote peace building between the two sides. And of course, at some point, ideally sooner rather than later, some just, stable, and agreeable peace over this very important issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
TV Paul is the James McGill Professor of International Relations at McGill University and the author of several articles and books, including the recently published Restraining Great Powers, Soft Balancing from Empires to the Global Era. And Mona Bond is the Ford Maxwell Chair of South Asian Studies in the Department of Anthropology at Syracuse University. She's the author of several books and articles and has recently co-edited a book on Kashmir, Resisting Occupation in Kashmir, with scholars from the Critical Kashmir Studies Collective, of which she is a founding member.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
سگجد میں درد چاہیے سگجد میں درد